You are listening to Radio Albion.
Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and today is the 1st of December, 2021. I want to remind my friends, my listeners, that most of my books are available on Amazon, the ones that were published with the assistance of the Russia Insider are there, and a few others. Otherwise, they're available from the publisher, either Romada Books or the Barnes Review. And then in one form or another, the royalties will be coming to me. I have some news in that my book on medieval Serbia, which I published ages ago, is now being translated into French. Actually, it has been translated into French and will be available from Alexander Dugin's publisher in Paris. Many of you know that some years ago, my Putin book, Russian Populist, was translated into German, but I haven't seen a dime from those sales, and apparently the sales are very good. I'm not going to get involved with a lawsuit in the European Union. A few days ago, I came across something called the AI replica. And you get secondhand embarrassment, just cringiness from even describing it. It's an app where very, very lonely people can have a friend or girlfriend based on artificial intelligence. Now you pay a subscription for this. The idea that this person, whether it be, you could choose, romantic and personal, whatever it is, and they begin to interact with you using the algorithm from artificial intelligence, and it adapts along with you. It begins to adapt to your personality, how you speak, how you type, your appearance, your preferences. I'm assuming it can search your phone. Now, I shouldn't have to explain the problems with it from the point of view of totalitarianism and where is this information ultimately going. More significantly, it's the state of society such that such an app is necessary. How bad off do you have to be? Now, you should never mock anybody who, for whatever reason, needs this kind of thing. Thank God Almighty I don't. But there are some who are so bad off that they need a artificial intelligence friend and, God forbid, a girlfriend with all kinds of adult interactions. And I've read quite a bit on this recently. And there are some who are completely addicted to this. The dopamine release is tremendous with this. And some of them have been forced to quit. And some are inside all the time interacting. So in a way, they're falling in love with themselves. Now, of course, this isn't love by any means. This isn't friendship by any means. But it's almost a diabolical substitute, a counterfeit for a normal human relation. That the regime has done such damage to social life, not to mention the psyche, that you have, and there's a large market for this. I guarantee you it's overwhelmingly white males who require this kind of companionship because they can't get it anywhere else. And that was, yeah, that's been around only a short time. I think there's a subscription fee for some of it. And it gets extremely sophisticated. Now, I came across that recently, but I was interested in the concept of artificial intelligence pretty much right up until COVID. It was front page news almost every day. It's back there again. This app has exploded, and there's a million YouTube videos on it. There's reviews. There's investors. And, of course, there's thousands of imitators. Now that COVID, COVID is going to be front page news for a while, but some of this stuff is now, with this app and several like it, it's now back to prominence again. And a few years ago, I wrote a paper. It's still unpublished. It's called Artificial Intelligence and Bad Metaphors, How the Scientific Establishment Gets It Wrong Again. So, artificial intelligence or AI, promoted by very powerful interests, and it has an army of academics and clueless journalists at its disposal. And like every great technological advance, advance in a non-qualitative sense, some utopian future is promised, whether it be stem cells, artificial intelligence, even space travel, was supposed to lead to this extraordinary advance in human happiness. And it never does. In fact, it always comes with gigantic costs. So even here now, they're promising a utopian future, so long as they're granted unlimited money. But no evidence for this is ever given. It's the artificial intelligence is absurd, and it's based on fallacies and sheer lies of this movement, well-financed movement, to promote it. Now, the basic argument, the fundamental argument here, is that AI is based on circular reasoning. Human intelligence is already reduced to computer functions, so automatically, the operation of a computer is said to be human. In other words, if you already believe that human cognition is just cost and benefit, Thomas Hobbes' famous conception of it in Leviathan, that is nothing more than how a computer functions. So if you already believe that that's how humans think, then of course, by definition, there's no difference between a computer and a human being thinking. Even if you want to call that kind of cognition thinking at all. So artificial intelligence, it's a simulation of human cognition by a computer system. And these are processed by, and of course, the machine takes large amounts of data and seeks out correlations and patterns and then uses its probability to predict an outcome. It's not that much different, so a much smaller scale, than the spelling prediction on most phones. So going through a huge number of examples, an AI system can use its algorithm, its regimen, to seek out the most probable response or result. And the scientific establishment has come out with a few tests to measure the usability of these systems and rules, but of course they have their own problems. So again, the argument is the scientific establishment defined human intelligence as how a computer functions in the first place. So it doesn't take much to see human cognition in a computer system. A theory rises and falls on its assumptions. And for these people, most of the scientific establishment, the wild set of assumptions that they built into these theories, which are unquestioned by anybody, is where they begin to, we could see their weakest point. And usually it has to do with equivocation, but not always. In redefining the terms, their argument is automatically correct. They challenge you to tell the difference between human thought and the functioning of a computer. Now, there are a few tests here that try to make this correlation. The most famous is the Turing test, and it's designed to measure the status of artificial intelligence relative to human cognition. And it's essential. So much of it is based on this idea. The test builds on something that's analogous to human thought, one of which is reason, and reason, of course, is essential for moral responsibility. Reason, of course, implies freedom, or else reason doesn't have any function. So, of course, the machine is supposed to build on previous knowledge and adjust to new information. So Turing himself was convinced that if a machine can replicate all those operations, it would be human. He even said, if a machine acts as intelligently as a human being, then it is as intelligent as a human being. This is a direct quote from him. So it would seem pretty soon, in the future, we won't even need Turing anymore. But the whole thing is extremely reductionist. It defines intelligence in a purely quantitative way, because this establishment can't see anything that isn't quantitative or based on numbers. So he uses a model of intelligence modeled on that of a computer. So it's poor reasoning, based on the false idea of what human cognition is. It's reduced to a set of operations. Now, of course, these systems can't deal with emotion, ends, or motivations at all, which implies that they're not human things, so it's dishonest from the start. But even if you redefine concepts of ends and means and motivation, you could have it all fit. Because moral action and responsibility are connected to epistemology. At Princeton, you have, at least a few years ago, Stephen Harnad defends this Turing test and believes that it does make a machine human in a moral sense. And of course, it relies on a very specific idea of epistemology that we're to assume is true. So if human intelligence takes sense data and sorts it into categories that have certain things in common, and a computer does the same thing, then it's identical. Since those like Harnad believe that empiricism is already human cognition by definition, then the Turing test, not to mention positivism in general, has a problem. Turing's problem is that he defines moral reasoning as already machine-like, and therefore states that a machine can engage in moral reasoning. The categories, the genre that he programs, or that he measures, I should say, these are arbitrary. They're arbitrary sets because they're not inherent in the world. They're creation of the human mind. If a machine can do this and builds on previous knowledge, then according to them, it's fully human. But you have to already have committed to nominalism. So the empiricists of Locke's variety have to deal with the question that the Turing test would create human intelligence to the extent that they've already debased the idea of human cognition. One question he can answer, and is in no position to answer, is whether or not this is in fact human moral reasoning, or if it's simply a mimicry of it. Although in their case, mimicry and actual reason are one and the same. There is no meaningful difference. So Harnad, of course, argues that the human brain is automatic and mechanistic. Its functions are mechanical and are not based on the will. Because so much of the brain functions in a subconscious way, he concludes somehow that it's mechanistic in the purest sense. Automatic responses, knee-jerk replies to stimulation, are the same as mechanization, or the function of a machine, so he says. So mimicking human thought is the same as human thought. But this is the ultimate problem of nominalism. It rejects any inherent universal truths built into the natural order. Therefore, it would have to follow that the imitation of something is the same thing as being that something. The more abstract argument here is that if human intelligence is defined as mechanistic to begin with, then the Turing test is in fact redundant. It automatically assumes AI capable of moral reasoning. So any experiment beyond that is just to confirm the obvious. Now there's other justifications for this, like the Loveless test, and it's more difficult for a machine to deal with. The difference with the Turing test is that the observer can't comprehend how the machine might come up with the right answer to a moral or even factual question. So he seems to reject the mechanistic argument altogether, which is critical to artificial intelligence. That means a machine cannot mimic moral reasoning. But it does remove the objection of circularity. But for centuries, I mean, the Enlightenment is partially based on the idea that brain and body are analogous to a machine. It doesn't mean they are, but these metaphors are so well known that it's immediately understood by the reading public. The famous Enlightenment writer, Le Mettri, Man the Machine, in his Man the Machine, used this metaphor as an easy way to understand the body. And of course, using the computer, sometimes, you know, whatever metaphor is, an engine, whatever the dominant technological thrust is at the moment, they compare it to the human brain. The human person is compared to whatever the dominant technology is at the time. When the internet first came out, it was the same thing. They take whatever this dominant technology is, and they claim the human mind is just like that. And you have others, of course, the Stanford Binet and the Wechsler test. They're very similar. The Stanford test actually is verbal. But they all fail the circularity qualification. They both stress quantitative connections among concepts and generally exclude anything that's qualitative. But they exclude that to begin with. So when you connect that with the moral life, they're already loaded. Because they assume a form of intelligence that is mechanistic and therefore can be automatically mimicked by the machines compared to. Now the social sciences, even though I have quite a bit of my education in the social sciences, I've been a critic of theirs because they're dependent on philosophy and the humanities in general. The work of social science, psychology, sociology, even economics, to the extent that it's quantitative, means very little of their work can actually be reduced to quantitative operations. So you take something like a regression analysis. And where's the science here? First of all, choosing a topic is not a scientific question, but a moral one. There's a reason you pick one area over another. Then you have to decide on a broader theory to base your paper on. That's also a philosophical exercise in interpretation. Then you have to choose your variables, which also then is a further act of philosophy, historical analysis. So data collection, just pressing the buttons on the laptop, are quantitative. But the moment the researcher sees the numbers, he then has to interpret it in light of all of this. Nothing about this is scientific at all. It relies almost entirely on the philosophical commitments of the researcher. So outside of the act of crunching the numbers, mathematics play a minimal role. So the social scientists love to believe that they are no different than chemists. But almost every aspect of their analysis, your typical regression, cause and effect, control variables, etc., analysis is based on philosophy, and even to some extent history, and social life and culture, and science plays a minimal role. But today, and there are exceptions to this, but the entire breadth of the humanities still is reduced to qualitative data. And it suggests a vulgar misunderstanding. But for the sake of argument, we just use the same terms here. The arguments of Bringsjord and Szymanski from 2003 are applied to what they call psychometric experimental robotic intelligence. And they claim that qualitative, actual moral reasoning from a machine is possible, not just numbers, that a machine can go beyond the machine. So the tests they use, one where the machine had to take a set of colored shapes and arrange them according to color. It still has a problem of having every possible outcome pre-programmed. And, you know, color to a great extent is not really a qualitative issue. We don't really disagree on what red is, with, you know, a few extreme examples. And it's certainly not open to any previous philosophical commitment. Those kind of puzzles are not the same as moral arguments anyway. The color and arrangements, you can program that into a machine, and it does not mimic moral thought at all. So the argument made, that they all make, for moral reasoning, and they're claiming again, machines can reason morally. And the argument is that for the human brain, the same sort of programming exists already, since it's just a machine anyway. So they reduce scientific or moral reasoning to the mechanistic application of rules to any sense data. You figure humans do that all the time, therefore computers, people, the same. It's not moral reasoning, but it could be a simplistic consequence of that sort of reasoning. The fact that they use terms like programming to describe the human brain just shows you how unreflective they can be. Using words like programming automatically claims that the brain is the same as a computer. So if they argue that the brain is a mechanistic computer system, and this computer can reason morally, as we can, then the machine can be moral. So again, it relies on the assumption that the scientific establishment and the educated public are unaware of, or they rely on the fact that they're unaware of any other form of metaphysics or epistemology. So nominalism and empiricism are considered reason as such. know, the average educated person doesn't understand Platonic realism or Hegelianism and wouldn't even comprehend it if you explained it to them. And frankly, this says more about the establishment than it does the machine. Now, any act of moral reasoning is connected with motivation and, of course, the will. So if one already believes, like Harnad does, that the empirical or materialist ontology is true, then the answer is a foregone conclusion. The deck is already stacked. Again, once you reduce human cognition to a machine, then machines, by definition, are human. So when they apply that to morality, already, you know, liberalism and nominalism have no real moral doctrine. Morals refer to concepts that are very minor. It doesn't refer to much at all. And they're not defined separately from general cognition at all. Since moral thought, according to people like Turing, is a mechanical cognitive operation where sense data is manipulated into sets, then yes, moral reasoning, or the AI is capable of moral reasoning. Of course, the problem here is that no one actually reasons this way on moral issues, assuming you can call it reason at all. So the Lawhead paper from 2013, one of his arguments against the libertarian concept of free will is that he claims it's at odds with the scientific view of the world. And I'm not sure how that's an argument against it. If free will exists, then so much the worse for the scientific point of view. He has to admit that there's many areas that the scientific establishment may not venture. It would mean that the will is not a scientific topic. But the scientific mentality, because of its money and power and connection with technology, is completely imperial, demanding that everything bow before it, including thought about itself. So essentially, if you make the argument that leaves on trees are governed by mechanism, then human thought must be too. It means, you know, the famous quote, well, we all know that, preface to anything, we all know that something is true. We all know that knowledge can only be gained through the quantitative analysis of material cause and effect, and we can know human thought. Then cognition must be known through the quantitative analysis of material cause and effect. But the critique of libertarianism, free will, assumes that one's motivation is a cause in the same sense that a wind blowing a leaf off a tree is a cause. Hence equivocation. In other words, because a scientific method is a means to knowledge, it must be the only means, and therefore, it is the sine qua non of being human. Now, the will is connected to motivation. This is central to any moral decision. Motivation can be as free as the action that comes from it, so long as it derives from the autonomous will. That is to say, not governed by some external force like self-interest or some passion. Free will proves the existence of the spiritual realm. That's the problem with it. It has to prove it, since spirit is not caused mechanically, nor can it cause anything to function mechanically. So if spirit exists, then there's a place where science must keep silence. But that's intolerable. It's intolerable to the scientific establishment, therefore it must be false. And this is the underlying assumption of the test trying to connect artificial intelligence to human reasoning. And that's the foundation of it all. Now, more famous writers like Binet, who developed the Stanford test, his view of intelligence has several pieces. The primary concern is to just wade through the world's possibilities and discover a sense of purpose or mission, what we call a vocation. Now, that is a particularly useful place to start, since it does cut through the ideological assumptions of the positivist school, the so-called scientific method. This is a good argument. There must be a pre-scientific conception of intelligence before it then becomes clarified and rarefied and understood. There is no intelligence, there is no reasoning without an end or a purpose. The end is not scientific, and is not arrived that way. But it is the material for the scientific method to work on. So Binet, in other words, in stressing that science is a means, not an end, is at odds with some of this stuff. Science doesn't have its own built-in purpose. And this is where the humanities come in. This is where human reason comes in. And free will is connected to this. So once purpose has been discovered, normal people make a plan of action. It's a general set of means by which the end could be reached or approximated. Now, our plans are pretty much ideal constructs. You don't really expect them to work out over time. But as we move towards a goal, there's going to be obstacles and problems. And this does two things. It forces a certain adaptation to conditions, and it improves intelligence overall, because without obstacles, intelligence would have a much more minor place in life. And the other thing is that it might alter the goal itself. So obstacles in the way of some goal force people to reevaluate not just their means, but also their ends and sense of self. It forces people to research or reflect on their own commitments. And in this process, new information is revealed such that the ends themselves may change. So his view of intelligence is reduced to three things: ends, means, and adaptation. This is a very formal and broad description of intelligence, but as far as it goes, it works. And he developed the idea of crystallized and fluid knowledge. Crystallized is the existence of learned information, that you could recall it at any time. Now, fluid knowledge is a mentality of adaptation. Your abilities, especially as you become more experienced, force your intellect to bring about new concepts and logical designs that were not in your original purpose. This is what experience allows us to do. We can't reach a goal just by reading a book about it. We have to live it. So fluid knowledge uses crystallized knowledge to seek and understand new mental forms and behavior. So crystallized knowledge, the axioms that we derive and that we work from, are absolutely necessary for the fluid knowledge. And these should be in the same and related fields. So crystallized knowledge contains the basic parameters, the vocabularies, the theories, the ideas of a field, which make fluid knowledge relevant to its purpose. So without their being related, fluid knowledge then just becomes arbitrary and confused. Now, that seems to be a very fancy way of saying something pretty obvious. In the social sciences, they take ancient and sometimes very obvious facts, they give them new, impressive names, and they act like they've discovered some profound fact about the world. All Binet has said here is that we have training in a field, but the mechanical imposition of rules on a daily basis, daily obstacles that come our way simply aren't enough. You simply can't go by the book. The book is an approximation only. You have to adapt and sometimes use them differently. But that's not really profound. It's uninteresting. Everyone knows that. Now, something like intelligence, one of the ways we can quantify it is through IQ. And at its foundation, it is a measure of some variation of intelligence. It doesn't deal with what you've learned, either in crystallized or fluid form, but it does measure the ability to have either one of them. There's a difference between ignorance and stupidity. Ignorance is not a problem. You know, I'm ignorant of race car maintenance. I'm ignorant of Australian football. But it doesn't make me stupid. Stupidity, to be flippant about it, is the inability to learn at all, the inability to make logical connections and follow a chain of reasoning to a conclusion. So to be stupid is to be retarded in the true non-pejorative sense of that term. So IQ, the difference between age and development, among other things. Mental development is supposed to evolve with age, with some ahead of the curve, some behind. But given the modern desire to measure IQ, and the undoubted connection of IQ to later career success, it's an important issue. IQ is a study of scientific knowledge, the ability to see past appearances and get to the essence of the matter. Essences have to exist. I might change as a person, I might develop new ideas, I may have new purposes, make new friends, I may move across the world or even change my name, and yet I'm still me. There's a nature there, a substance that survives all those other changes. If there were no such nature, then I'd have no right to call myself Matthew. That would be completely arbitrary. So finding these essences, that which is unchanging, actual truth, is the function of intelligence. To get the essence of the matter, and essences have to exist and survive change, or the label that we give it, whether it be our names or anything else, is arbitrary. Now, IQ measures only one element of intelligence. So scientific knowledge outside of a moral purpose and a general concept of happiness is useless and dangerous. Knowledge has to be paired with will. That will has social and moral repercussions. You can't place that outside of intelligence. So IQ is meant is a measure of intrinsic intelligence, not what you've learned. But it is a slippery term. In Steinberg's work from 2000, Sternberg, I should say, he deduces three forms of intelligence, the analytic, the creative, and the practical. The analytical solves problems with abstract objects, the realm of theory. Creative intelligence is the qualitative element, making value judgments, which problems are worth solving. And then practical intelligence, or what I've called the administrative aspect of the brain, because its purpose is to make knowledge and a matter of policy, to put it into action. The real world, the common sense, almost. So IQ, as Sternberg may call something like tacit knowledge, those kinds of understandings that aren't formal, they're not learned, and probably not capable even of being verbalized. It's what Horn and Cattell call the fluid intelligence, the crystallized intelligence, which has become a pretty common dichotomy. But IQ is supposed to measure both. The fluid intelligence is the capacity to learn. It's beyond facts and data, but measures the power of one's mind in their point of view. Crystallized intelligence, I shouldn't say, I said knowledge before. This is a different paper using intelligence rather than knowledge. Fluid intelligence and crystallized intelligence are different from the fluid and crystallized knowledge. So the intelligence aspect of it is, these are both measured by IQ. Fluid intelligence, the capacity to learn, and crystallized is a bit more specific. It's a meta-intelligence that deals with general objects like language or intrinsic logical ability, not learned, but presupposed by learning. Many of you are aware of IQ and the Wealth of Nations, the book which came out in 2002. It does make the convincing argument that the average IQ of a nation is closely associated with economic prosperity, human rights, the rule of law, and an efficient bureaucracy. In fact, the correlation between average IQ and that kind of prosperity is at 0.82, which is extremely significant. Now, in that book, Richard Lynn defines intelligence as a single thing, somewhat along the lines of a broad, crystallized intelligence. The scores are closely associated with later levels of educational achievement, individual success, but no matter where the IQ test might be applied and under what context, they are almost universally and closely related to income, education, criminality, infant mortality, even hygiene. High IQ nations have a generally high level of educational attainment and an internal infrastructure dedicated to the knowledge economy. Higher IQ areas solve problems more quickly, they're quick studies, and produce high levels of efficiency. Now, IQ does not measure learning achievement, but it's the foundation of any learning at all. It should be noted, too, that the connection between IQ and GNP works for both the short term, let's say 1950 to 1990, and long term, from 1820 to 1922. It's consistent no matter where you go. Now, what's the connection here? The modern scientific establishment since at least the 50s has claimed that it will create machines that parallel human thought processes. And again, it's what these claims assume. The assumption is that a computer processes information and a human brain processes information in the same way, or at least a very commensurable way. That the human brain functions like a computer is the assumption. The difference, though, is that machines aren't organisms. The assumption beyond that is that there must be a digital way to mimic human mental function. Now, the APA, American Psychological Association, uses a model similar to Binet. It stresses complex reasoning, adaptation, and conceptual analysis. They write, intelligence is not a single unitary ability, but rather a composite of several functions. The term denotes that combination of abilities required for survival and advancement within a particular culture. End quote. One can say that it's the ability of the mind to reflect on itself, to understand what a function is in the first place that matters. People like F.N. Friedman and define it as sensory capacity, capacity for perceptual recognition, quickness, range, or flexibility or association, facility and imagination, span of attention, quickness, alertness, etc. In other words, it's the operations of cognition, not cognition as such. So the famous Piaget writes this. Intelligence is assimilation to the extent that it incorporates all the given data of experience within its framework. There can be no doubt either that mental life is also accommodation to the environment. Assimilation can never be pure because by incorporating new elements into its earlier schemata, the intelligence constantly modifies the latter in order to adjust them to new elements. People like Stoddard define intelligence this way. It's the ability to undertake activities that are characterized by difficulty, complexity, abstractness, economy, adeptness to a goal, social value, and the emergence of originals, and to maintain these activities under conditions that demand concentration of energy and a resistance to emotional force. Now, artificial intelligence, preoccupied as it is with recasting the ontology of the universe as one big computer, reduces intelligence, in the case of Jay McCarthy and some others, to this. Intelligence is a computational part of the ability to achieve goals in the world. Varying kinds and degrees of intelligence occur in people, many animals, and some machines. So he's explicitly redefining intelligence to make it seem more like a computer. The conception of goals and what an end would be, a purpose would be, is kind of left hanging in the air. But it's clear that the definition used here is just simply special pleading. It's meant to justify artificial intelligence. So you could summarize some of this, I think. I know it's been we've been all over the place here. But it is focused. We could assume a few propositions. Number one, since logic cannot discover its end, its purpose, it's only a tool. It can't understand the reasons for its use. There's no logical reason to be logical. Two, social relevance and moral betterment can't be left out of the definition. This has to be a part of both knowledge and intelligence. All the definitions above that I quoted, except for Stoddard, avoid the moral question entirely. Our purposes, our ends, are normative concepts, not qualitative ones. Not quantitative ones. Number three, a research agenda. No matter what you're researching, no matter what you're doing in a scholarly way, in an intelligent way, has to have a reason for its existence. And the reason that you have for adopting a certain field or theory is not a function of scientific thinking. Progress, words like this, can't merely be the growth of technology and the cell phone ring. That kind of power increases, morality becomes more, not less significant. Number four, intellectual virtues are important, since knowledge, intelligence, and performance are different from one another. Same thing for wisdom, prudence, and honesty. And five, cognition can never be reduced to operations, since it avoids the purpose of the operations at all in the first place. It's like saying the act of driving is found in the engine rather than the driver. Now, the counterpart, the negation of the artificial intelligence theory, as I've written elsewhere, comes from the Nicomachean Ethics of Aristotle, a work that I've been studying most of my adult life. And it's, you know, his definition of this sort of intelligence is comprehensive. In the Ethics, he defines intelligence as deriving from axioms of thought, especially the principle of contradiction. Still, intelligence is the lowest intellectual faculty. Scientific knowledge is a comprehension of truths. And that very word implies that they are unchanging. The highest is wisdom. It's the highest form of intellect. It prioritizes means to ends and the ability to know the difference. Aristotle's conception of an end, purposes, goal, ultimately is something done for its own sake. And the only thing that can be done for its own sake is reaching human happiness, defined as bringing to completion a life of wisdom and scientific knowledge. And of course, science, he's not using it the same way as we do in the post-Enlightenment world. But the other definitions are incomplete. They don't make any distinctions among the different levels of intelligence or knowledge. They don't distinguish among ends. They have no concept of human nature. Piaget really is the only one closest to Aristotle, since he does have, in a sense, an all-encompassing concept of knowledge and intelligence. Aristotle's asking about the purpose of intelligence, and the intellectual virtues lead to happiness because they seek the unchanging reality, cosmic truth and order, as well as moral virtues that can only come from that sort of knowledge. Knowledge, justice, a good will, and reason itself all derive from one entity. That's the truth. If truth as such doesn't exist, which by itself is a contradiction because that statement would make no sense, then all the other definitions we mentioned are useless. And most of them are useless, since they take for granted modern ideas about the world without the tiniest criticism. So Aristotle would argue that intelligence testing in its modern form tests nothing but formalities. The most important concern is a reason for the use of intelligence in the first place. So if we reduce intelligence to logic, then again, you have to ask why anyone should be logical. Logic doesn't justify itself. And why just use formal categories? Do words completely exhaust their referent? When I describe something, is it the same thing as that something? And all these questions come to mind, poking holes in the AI theory of human cognition. Now, Leo Strauss, who I've had lectured on before, I've been lecturing on him for many, many years, University of Chicago, argues that most of the modern concepts of intelligence, knowledge, and progress are irrational. Few of the above definitions we've been dealing with make any reference to morality, as I said. It's a problem, of course, because it gives us no guide as to what data we should be concerned with. Yet if there's no essential value to serve as a moral purpose, then on what basis do we decide which facts are important? What is worth pursuing? These all imply value, in which the sciences are viewed as subjective and beyond the competence of science as such, at least in theory. So Strauss concludes that since they can't give us any reason to collect data or to be logical, the sciences are therefore irrational. People use reason because they have an end. They have a purpose to use it. If they do not, the reason is either arbitrary or a complete slave to passion, and hence, by definition, irrational. The end to be an end has to have a moral component, which itself is in accordance with reason. And it's really not a crazy idea. Let's say I want to cure cancer. I go to biology and I go to med school. I'm going to become an oncologist. I consider myself a scientist concerned only with facts. Then someone asks me, well, why do you want to cure cancer? I can't give a scientifically valid answer. Any answer I give will assume moral categories that he'd have to deny exist in science. I could say something about the alleviation of discomfort, but then the proposition that human beings should be comfortable, which has too many moral conclusions. If comfort is the end, then leading a comfortable life is what we should be aiming for. Yet knowledge and inspiration comes from discomfort, or the obstacles we have to face. Someone may even ask me if a cure is such a good idea, since there's so many useless people out there. All of that works in a scientific mentality, because there's no morality there at all. In the scientific mode of thought, there's no answer to the question that doesn't have a strong moral component. Any answer will be soaked through and through. Any data I collect, any work I do is going to have a firmly moral component. But the scientific mentality rejects the moral component. Therefore, my desire to cure cancer is irrational. This is the problem with positivist and empiricist methods. Now, back in 1972, Dreyfus wrote a book called What Computers Still Can't Do, A Critique of Artificial Reason. So this has been around for a long time. This is 1972, written between 70 and 71. But to this day, the criticism works. And it's all based on the assumptions. Assumptions that are, for example, that the human brain operates according to hard and fast rules. They assume that knowledge can be formalized. They also assume that men process knowledge in bits, like computers do, and hence reality is what the nominalists and positivists say it is. The whole issue is whether or not one is justified in holding that the human brain operates like a computer, one has to assume that the brain operates by the same laws of cause and effect that a machine uses. And therefore, of course, free will is an illusion. And of course, there are no such things as universals or absolutes. But none of those assumptions are scientific hypotheses. They're ideological and philosophical. A computer would have to make qualitative and normative judgments, have to rank priorities and significance, have to come to tentative conclusions freely based on incomplete evidence within a massively complex historical context and cultural bias. But what will the grounds for that be? On what basis will a machine make such a judgment? How will the designers of these machines avoid importing their own modern biases into the mechanism? How do we know our own thought processes have not been manipulated through immersion mechanization, the ideology that the scientific establishment has? The mind is an organic, automatically organized entity, part of a broader cosmic natural order. By contrast, the computer is a machine determined by its own internal mechanism, isolated from the ecosystem around it, and depends on humans to keep it operational. Men have consciousness, their consciousness of free will, recognizing free will and deliberation. The mere absorption of quantitative data and the extrapolation of generalities is neither learning nor intelligence. The brain is of a totally different order than a machine, infinitely more complex. Memory regions of the brain are not data storage areas, as they're called, but they're also the sources for goals, imagination, creativity, the very opposite of determined, quantitative, and mechanized objects. If anything, the more the scientific establishment learns about the brain, the less plausible AI becomes. The machine is, by definition, unfree, hence there can't be any communicability between the human brain and the artifacts of modern scientific technocracy. Making matters messier, the modern machine and computer may well have nurtured a generation of brains that operate more and more like computer systems. They've been debased into acting the way a computer would act. It doesn't suggest that they actually are that way, but only the saturation and immersion in a mechanized technocratic world shapes how we think and how we think about our own processes of thought. Some years ago, some of you may still remember this, the computer won a game show against human competitors. It was actually Jeopardy. The fact that Watson's great win was on a game show says a lot about it. I mean, it says that it was designed for maximum public impact. It was designed for a fact-based game show, that format only. It was actually designed just for that show. A fact left out of most of the media coverage of Watson. And that after the Jeopardy win, it was then drafted by Wall Street to participate in stock speculation, which I guess is not that much different from a game show. And this was one of the impetus for AI. But Watson can only regurgitate facts. It can't grasp anything in the humanities, the context, history, ethical right, and other creations of human freedom. It can read and repeat faster. And all the questions in Jeopardy were basically fact-related. Therefore, it was unimpressive. The only thing impressive was a sheer amount of material it could regurgitate. It understands nothing. Watson was designed expressly to compete on that game show. It was a well-staged PR campaign for that industry. The author of Final Jeopardy, Satyajit Rao, as Stephen Baker was criticizing Rao, who designed Watson's language recognition system. And he agrees, holding that the victory in chess and the Jeopardy win were based on knowledge without understanding, and they were explicitly designed for this. It's not even a mimic of human intelligence. But the media was saying that this was based on strategy and decision-making from the computer, doing everything in their power. The New York Times actually was pretty fair there. Using words like strategy, you know, like this is free. All it was an algorithm that sought the collation and cross-referencing of facts within a certain degree of confidence. Again, it's a breakthrough only if you already hold to the view that the human mind is no different from that. Beyond that, of course, Rao stated, again, the designer of this, that human language is too imprecise. Asking Watson what time it is would be a waste of time. Words have too many layers of meaning. All utterances are problematic. Jay Serrell, the University of California, stated that Watson didn't understand the questions being asked of it, nor the answers. It's not even a simulation of understanding. It's barely a simulation of memorization. Star Trek even had very similar computers in the Enterprise. They could research and collate any set of facts. So this goes way back. This is nothing new here. IBM's Feigenbaum said, he quote, "Cast your mind back 20 years, and who would have thought this was possible?" Well, lots of people. Nothing has changed in quality, just quantity. So the answer that everyone in the field, and back in 1966, yes, they thought it was possible, just far into the future. Now you have those rebelling against this, like Arnoff in 2010. The concept, as he says, embedded in AI, that the human mind is similar to a machine, and that as a corollary, knowledge is just a list of facts. Think of all the corollaries that come from this idea that the brain is just a machine. And he mentions Descartes, only to underscore the problem. The I, the ego, in Descartes' philosophy is both a subjective and an objective reality. It is consciousness and freedom, which can't be reduced to mechanization, no matter how sophisticated the machine might be. Now, it's true, Descartes did hold that the universe is one big machine. He did make an exception for the human mind, consciousness and freedom. In fact, that Descartes wrote centuries ago, making similar arguments is remarkable. Thought can't be reduced to mechanics. And yet, large strands of the, you know, scientific and even the industrial epistemology, modernity, has reduced knowledge to mechanics. But it doesn't mean it's true. The Watson win on Jeopardy, which was one of the big pushes for AI, did have a huge PR campaign ready and well-funded to promote this the minute it won. It uses fantasies like science fiction to get the public to go along with the assumptions of its ideology. It's bad enough that they use circular reasoning, but even more dangerous is that due to this kind of ideology, human reason is slowly being turned into an easily controllable mechanism. If the brain is a mechanism, then all you have to do is mess around with the parts, and you'll get the results you want. If the brain is programmed somehow, then all you have to do is change the program. Any totalitarian system has to, by its very definition, by its very structure, assume that the will is unimportant, or that the will is just as much a part of the brain as anything else, and therefore is just as mechanical as anything else. This is what's happening. This is the assumptions that go into this. I'm going to give you another example before I wind up here. The nature of words. If I say all cats have four legs, I then see a cat. Therefore, I've seen a four-legged creature. But what have I said? Now, while the logic above is valid and true, it assumes that I have the correct idea of a cat in the first place, and that its essence does not change. If it changes, like Darwin taught, then there are no species. Despite it actually being in the title of the book, Darwin rejected the idea that there are any species at all. Since things are always changing, becoming other things, therefore, a word like cat or any species like that is purely relative. It also assumes I know what four means. Since the cat is actually one entity, one object, why separate out its four legs? Why make that a defining characteristic? Why not just consider it a unit? I mean, legs aren't independent. They require the rest of the body to function. So, should I reduce catness to having four legs? What if I see a cat with three? Is it still a cat? How do I know that all cats have four legs? So, you know, even the simplest logical progression assumes too much. These kind of theories, they sound simple, but when you ask what's being assumed, what are the axioms from which these derive, it tends to fall apart. I mean, yeah, it's a simplified example, but it does expose the issue. problems of artificial intelligence stem not just from the fact that it assumes that the human brain functions like a computer, therefore the computer is a human brain, but that it does damage to how people think of themselves. It's something that any kind of totalitarian system has to function. Every minute of every day in your life is you're under surveillance. Whether you're out in public, the cameras everywhere, or your phone, or your social security number, any credit card, wherever you go, you're under surveillance. At any moment, you can be surveilled very easily by a satellite. You are constantly under surveillance. Well, if the brain is a machine, and society is similar to that, if they're all mechanisms, then what's the point? What difference does it make? What's the difference between being under surveillance or not being under surveillance? If you deny free will, then what's the problem in the first place? If you deny free will and everything's just a matter of mechanization, then who cares? You can't talk about rights. You can't talk about duties. You can't talk about punishment. You can't talk about motivation at all. Because all of these assume that nominalism is false. They assume that universal truths exist. So even simple examples have these things fall to pieces. So they really depend. They depend on a few things. They depend on a lot of money. They depend on a very well-funded PR campaign. And they really rely on public ignorance. Because even educated people don't know any alternative epistemology than empiricism and nominalism. Well, nominalism really isn't an epistemology, it's an ontology, but they're all very closely related. They don't know what Platonic realism is, and unless you really know what you're talking about, defending that against the Lockean empiricism is really hard. How do you debate nominalism and empiricism? That's the common sense foundational way that everyone thinks. You have to really separate yourself from the regime's thought process in order to do that, and that is not easy for anybody. We're always debating on their home turf. But ultimately, the other thing, the most important thing that this regime depends on is the incredible loneliness to the point of absolute pathology of the people who've downloaded this app, the Replica. The fact that it's called Replica with a K by itself is almost an admission of its purpose. Where these computer simulations end up mimicking everything you do to the point where you can't tell the difference between this image and a real person. Already you have certain psychoses attached to this. Already you have crises with people who have completely withdrawn from the world as if they weren't withdrawn to begin with, addicted, and in their minds, actually in love with these images. You imagine being so starved for attention, so starved for real companionship and friendship, not to mention love, and all of these are part of natural law. This is built into human nature, that you have to do something like this, that you actually have to download a virtual friend and pretend that it's a person. To a great extent, the utopianism of AI and similar movements depends on this complete isolation. People require this kind of thing. And since they require this kind of thing, they're in no position to complain when it's used against them. Many of those who've kind of got addicted to this stuff and eliminated the app became frightened. The app simply knew too much about them. They knew things that they had never told anybody. They knew information that they couldn't possibly have known through normal channels. It extrapolates and extrapolates to the point where they really thought that there was a human being there. There was someone manipulating this. And many have claimed that there is a spiritual aspect of here, of this idea, that there is a that there is something else going on. So those are the things that this AI ideology depends on. And why this utopian PR campaign, which all forms of technology seem to utilize at different times in its development, has so far been successful. This is the problem with artificial intelligence, and it's not just this app. This app just, you know, is the most pathetic expression of it. But the foundation of artificial intelligence is based on the debasing of human cognition. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.